From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. The North Carolina Fisheries Reform Act will be 20 years old this August. It was the result of heated debate from stakeholders on all sides of the issue, and while most describe it as a compromise bill signed by Governor Jim Hunt in 1997, most also say it was better than nothing at the time. There is new legislation coming through the pipeline in Raleigh that could fundamentally change the way fisheries are regulated, and that has reignited the decades-old battle not just between recreational and commercial fishermen. It's reopened questions around what responsible, sustainable fisheries management looks like. Today, our task is not to debate the merits of the current legislative proposals. Rather, we're going to find out how we got here in the first place. We're going to turn the clock back 20 years or more, and talk with some of the key stakeholders who helped to craft that compromise legislation known as the Fisheries Reform Act. Joining us now from the studios of member station WUNC is B.J. Copeland. He's a former associate professor of limnology at North Carolina State University. He served as director of the North Carolina Sea Grant College. He's been a member of the North Carolina Marine Fisheries Commission and the Fisheries Moratorium Steering Committee. B.J. Copeland, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you.
Also with us right now, Jess Hawkins. He's a former marine biologist with the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries from 1978 to 2006, and he served as a Marine Fisheries Commission liaison from 1995 to 2006. He also served on that commission. Welcome, Jess Hawkins.
Good morning.
And we're inviting your questions on this Thursday about what led us to today. I want to remind people we'll tackle the current legislation and the way stakeholders are proposing to change policy on an upcoming edition of Coastline. You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. B.J. Copeland, it was more than 20 years ago that recreational and commercial fishermen discovered they had competing needs regarding fisheries management. But take us back in time before that public debate emerged. What did fishing contribute to North Carolina's economy and its culture, its identity?
Well, commercial fishermen, as you know, has been an age-old enterprise on the coast, and it contributed a considerable amount of money, but more importantly, a culture to North Carolina's coastal communities. Recreational fishing was growing by leaps and bounds at the time. Lots of people are getting away from the grind of everyday living and going fishing. And so recreational fishing was a big draw for the coastal tourism economy, which is a big factor in our state.
How long has commercial fishing been an important industry in North Carolina?
Ever since the first English settlers traded bulldogs for shad up in Albemarle Sound, it's been going on. So it's about 400 years.
And Jess?
So we've been doing it a long time.
Jess Hawkins, what kind of fish back in the 20th century, let's go back, say, over the last 100 years, what kinds of fish did North Carolina commercial fishermen expect to get?
Well, early on, like what BJ said, the shad and the herring fisheries were the most important fisheries on the Atlantic coast, and they were the most important for our state. Then we had substantial oyster fisheries, then the shrimp fishery developed, and then in the I guess the 1940s or so, we started catching large amounts of menhaden, which local people call them shad or bunker, and they were used for processing. They secured fish oil from them, and so we had, Beaufort was known as Fish Town because it had so many fish factories to process those menhaden. Another species that was in the rivers were called striped mullet, or locals call them jumping mullet. You have them down here in Cape Fear River. And they're real prominent fish or common fish in the estuaries.
B.J. Copeland, why is North Carolina's coastal waters, why are they different from neighboring states?
Well, for one thing, very importantly, Cape Hatteras protrudes into the ocean way out there. And so you have the northern waters on the north side of that and the southern waters on the south side of that, and they meet there. So we get the advantage of both temperate and subtropical fisheries, joining our coast. We also, Hatteras area is the most variable weather-wise of any place in this country, in North America. And so we're sitting in a very mixed master of things that create an environment that supports a lot of stuff.
And when you think about when the concern over depleted fisheries started to enter the conversation, Jess Hawkins, around what time in the 20th century did that happen, and what were the species of concern at the time?
Well, we've been blessed in our state with numerous university labs that have studied fisheries issues, and UNC had a lab in Moorhead. And if you look back in history, they actually produced studies in the 1950s regarding concerns about species such as croaker, weakfish. Shad have been an issue. UNC didn't work that much on them. And then they had a federal lab that produced a study in the 20s up to the 30s. And they documented concerns about different species. And so so that was really the genesis of looking at fish. And then we actually, if you go back farther in time than that, our oyster resource was so important that actually North Carolina had a small skirmish or war with Virginia over oyster harvest. So oysters, the competing nature of oyster harvest has been an issue for since the 1800s, early 1900s. So it's been part of our legacy for a while. And on your question about the uniqueness about North Carolina, we also have very, very large estuaries. So that also produces very productive fisheries, both recreationally and commercially. We have the largest estuary in any one state in the whole country. So Pamlico Sound, Almar Sound. And so that provides a great place for people like you and I to fish for fun or for people to fish commercially.
And for those folks who aren't familiar with all the terms, describe what an estuary is.
An estuary, and BJ can correct me if I say something wrong, is it's a mixture of salt water.
Where the river meets the ocean.
That's right. It's where salt water mixes with fresh water. So so we call that an estuary, and then it turns into a river. And so like the Cape Fear River has salt in it close to the mouth, and since it's so deep, it has salt in it a fair amount up, and that's called an estuary. And then when it turns completely fresh, we turn that a river.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's an exploration of North Carolina's fishing industry, both commercial and recreational, and why a piece of compromise legislation from 1997 that set the rules for managing fisheries could see some big changes. Right now, we're talking with Jess Hawkins. He's a former marine biologist with the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries, and B.J. Copeland, former associate professor at NC State University, also former director of the North Carolina Sea Grant College, and he served on the North Carolina Marine Fisheries Commission and the Fisheries Moratorium Steering Committee. We're taking your questions on this Thursday. You can call us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. Let's move into the 1980s now. B.J. Copeland, take us back to the time that marine biologists and policymakers started looking around in North Carolina saying, there might be a problem here. We might need to develop some kind of policy regulating these fisheries.
Well, we had several things that kind of came together. One was we had thousands of people holding licenses to use commercial gear, and we had really had no way of getting a hold of that. We also had the situation of a fisheries management commission that had 17 or 18 or 19 members, depending on what day it was, and so we couldn't get anything done. And so all of these led up to establishing a moratorium on new regulations and new things, so we could just get a fresh start.
Jess Hawkins, what was your role in this?
I was initially a biologist supervisor for the area that covered most of Pamlico Sound. And so a lot of the issues that BJ faced when he was on the commission or even with Sea Grant involved the area I was responsible for. And then I received a promotion where I was the liaison with the commission, Marine Fisheries Commission. And so every rule that was developed, I was involved in that for our state. So I was familiar with a variety of issues or array of issues that were facing our state. And so then when the moratorium on rulemaking was passed, we started these studies that BJ was involved with the Moratorium Steering Committee, and I was involved with that. So I'd go to the meetings and listen to input and provide input. And so before we put the moratorium steering moratorium in place, I might add that we started to get more issues with competition and conflict. The crab pot fishery was growing at leaps and bounds, and we had a licensing structure that a lot of crabbers wanted to change. The number of pots were causing conflicts with sailors and swimmers and other types of fishing. And then we had a lot of recreational fishermen that wanted to use certain areas. And so we had actually zoned areas for recreational fishermen fishing in the late 80s. And so all those issues were coming together. And in addition to what kind of science did we need to try to determine truth, and what kind of science did we need to turn direction? And so the Moratorium Steering Committee helped us with that too.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're exploring the contribution of fishing to North Carolina's culture and economy, and why 20 years ago a complicated debate erupted between recreational and commercial fishing interests. If you have a question about the history of fisheries management in North Carolina, you can reach us today at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. The phone lines are now open. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're talking today about the challenges of creating policy to manage fisheries amidst competing interests, and how a long and historic debate led to the compromise legislation called the Fisheries Reform Act of 1997. With us now is Dick Brame. He's the first executive director of the Coastal Conservation Association of North Carolina. He has also served as the CCA Fisheries Director for the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, and he is the current CCA Fisheries Director for the Gulf of Mexico Fishery Management Council and South Atlantic Fishery Management Council. Dick Brame, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Jerry Schill is also with us now. He is the Director of Government Relations, and he's the former president of the North Carolina Fisheries Association. Welcome, Jerry Schill.
Thank you.
And still with us right now is Jess Hawkins, former marine biologist with the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries. He also served on the Marine Fisheries Commission and as the Marine Fisheries Commission liaison. And we're taking your questions on this Thursday about the history of fisheries and the 1997 Reform Act. You can call us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Just before we went to break, we had started to talk about the moratorium on commercial fishing licenses. And Jess Hawkins, can you just bring us up to speed on what that meant and why that was instituted? This was just putting a stop on the number of commercial fishing licenses that could be issued?
Yes, we had about 30,000 licenses at the time, and they were attached to a vessel. And so the discussions were, you know, should we have individual license? Should we simplify the license structure? And so a lot of these questions. And so the moratorium was issued on issuing new licenses, but also there was a moratorium on any new rulemaking unless the General Assembly passed something or a resource was endangered, or it was a federal compliance. And so it actually gave a chance for stakeholders and the policymakers to take a breath and to look at it. And so they formed this committee that BJ was on, and I don't know if Dick, were you on the?
I
They formed this committee to study those issues. And as BJ had told you earlier, you know, our fisheries are very diverse. We have a long history in it. Our recreational fishing was growing at the time, and so it was strong potential for that. So they said, let's take a breath. And
so this was really putting the brakes on everything. Just
correct.
Everybody stop so that we can study it. And Dick Brame, can you tell us about the impact that this moratorium had on recreational fishermen?
Well, first, what I'd like to point out, and I agree with Jess, is
what it was like before they put the moratorium in place. There would seem to be a new regulation or a new attempt at a regulation every other meeting. There was no coherent reason why we were doing it, seemed to
okay,
the public.
Okay, give us a historical context. What time frame are we talking about now?
In the late 80s and early 90s. It was sort
okay.
of a shotgun approach. If you had a problem, you went to the Marine Fisheries Commission, they tried to address it, and then the next meeting it'd be something to address something else. This was a way to sort of stop the clock and reset.
And so this was something that everybody agreed to. Was there an impact, Jerry Schill, on commercial fishermen?
Oh, certainly. More to a commercial fisherman's psyche than anything, because it was a trying time for everybody. But Dick is correct. I mean, it was a trying time for all users when every time you went to a meeting, there was another regulation. But the situation with commercial fishing was that they came through the 1950s when a lot of folks left North Carolina because there weren't any fish here. They went to the Gulf of Mexico and down in the Keys in Florida. They took their boats, and many folks in North Carolina had children born down there at that particular time. So they were coming through that, understanding that there were some changes in fish populations in North Carolina, but at the same time realized that there are also something called cycles that they were used to dealing with. And so it was just a trying time for everyone at that particular, when the Moratorium Steering Committee started their work.
Were there representatives from the commercial fishing side on the Moratorium Steering Committee?
Yes, it was well represented by all user groups on the Steering Committee.
Jess Hawkins.
Yeah, one thing that we hadn't mentioned, which I should have mentioned earlier, and I apologize, is there were also concerns about water quality habitat. So we had green water in our rivers, you know, from algae blooms. You had shellfish closures. So there was an attempt to try to do something to get the natural resource, the environmental commissions talking and working together to try to protect the habitat and water quality for recreational commercial fishermen and the fish itself.
Why was the water quality degrading at the time?
Well, most experts, BJ, could speak to that. It was excess nutrients. And so that's when we passed a lot of nutrient-sensitive regulations mainly to protect the Neuse River, the Chowan River, the Pamlico River, and so they put a phosphate ban in place, which slowed some of that down. So we do not have the algal blooms that we used to have back when this was all coming to a head. So that seemed to have worked.
What was the source of the nutrient pollution at the time? Is that upstream, concentrated
upstream.
Animal feeding operations?
A lot of our towns upstream use the rivers as a source of water for sewage treatment and as a source for drinking. So they still do so to this day. And so the treatment, it was both, we call it point source, which means it comes out of a pipe. So those standards were tightened. And then they had non-point sources, which would be farming and forestry, which we have a long history in farming, long history in forestry. And so they put in measures to try to help some of those that input. So,
you're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's an exploration of North Carolina's fishing industry, both commercial and recreational, and why a piece of compromise legislation from 1997 that set the rules for managing fisheries could see some big changes. Here to answer your questions on this Thursday, Dick Brame. He's the Coastal Conservation Association Fisheries Director for the Gulf of Mexico Fishery Management Council and the South Atlantic Fishery Management Council. Also here, Jess Hawkins, former marine biologist with the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries and former member of the Marine Fisheries Commission. And Jerry Schill, he's the Director of Government Relations for the North Carolina Fisheries Association. You can ask your own question on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org.
At this point, I'm having a hard time understanding why there would be a divergence between recreational and commercial fishing interests. If everybody agrees at this point that water quality is a concern, that there's a depletion among certain kinds of fish, and something has to be done about it, where was that divergence, Jerry Schill?
Well, you know, I started getting involved in fisheries in 1987. Even then, there was a lot of controversy because it's not about conservation many times, it's about allocation. Once you decide, once you get through the contentious debates about how many fish you can harvest, then it's who's going to harvest it, what group is going to get it. What many people don't understand is that the angst isn't just between commercial, recreational, environmental. It's also within the commercial fishing industry. So not everybody agrees. I can attest that every month we have board meetings that last 4 or 5 hours long, and I used to hear that farmers were similar to, or fishermen were similar to farmers in being independent. Fishermen are the most independent group I have ever dealt with in my entire life. And as such, they have very strong opinions. And so the angst within the fishing community isn't just recreational versus commercial. You have to throw in the environmentalist factor in there as well. And then the differences even within the commercial fishing industry. So it's natural. It's just a natural thing.
Tension
that sure.
That's going to be there. So do you think, Jerry Schill, that there's a perception or there has been a perception that commercial fishermen don't really care about the environment, don't really care as much about fisheries management? They just want to harvest what they can and make their living and move on?
There's some of that. I don't think it's widespread, though. But I know that when my baptism by fire, talking about water quality issues, was a red tide that hit in 1987. And that was devastating the commercial fishing industry, not just in how it affected shellfish, but it made it very, very difficult to sell any seafood coming out of North Carolina. Again, the key word that you mentioned, I think, is perception. I think we're driven more by perception than we are reality at times. So there is that element of wondering how vested is the commercial fishing industry as far as taking care of the environment. But ever since the 1980s when I started, we've been dealing with bycatch concerns and things like that and trying to be proactive about it.
Dick Brame, was the recreational fishing industry, was that interest getting squeezed out during the time that all of this fisheries management discussion was going on?
Well, yeah. The recreational fishermen depend on excess and abundance. And the commercial fishery depends on yield. And that's two different ways to manage. I mean, we like a lot of – most recreational fishermen are like me. They're pretty poor fishermen. They need to have access to a lot of fish in order to catch some. So I think that's sort of the genesis of the angst is what the two fisheries want out of the resource.
And
so we felt squeezed out, and we're actually happy to have a seat at the table of the Moratorium Steering Committee.
How much of an impact on the North Carolina economy was the recreational part of the fishing industry having back in the day? And I'm thinking of the late 80s and early 90s before the Fisheries Reform Act came to be.
Well, it really started to blossom in the late 70s and early 80s when I was coming along. A lot of fishermen, a lot of people had leisure time, more and more boats. The advent of the reliable outboard motor did more for that than anything else, because people could go out of sight of land without feeling unsafe. So there was a real boom in recreational fishing in the 80s.
Jess Hawkins.
Yeah, and just to confirm what Dick was saying is, right now a lot of people don't know that, you know, North Carolina is like in the top four in our country in terms of recreational fishing trips, in terms of numbers of fish caught. And so it's a very, very, very important state recreationally in terms of our nation. And so a lot of people do not know that, because we're blessed with those abundant areas to fish. And there's a lot of people, like Dick said, that like to try to catch those for fun.
Is it hard to tease out recreational fishing from the rest of North Carolina's tourism economy, Dick Brame?
No.
Okay, how do we do that? What do we have numbers?
Economists do it regularly.
And do we have numbers on that? Do you
know?
Yes,
they are. I can't recall them off the top of my head. But yes, we do.
So what is the rough breakdown between what, and I know this doesn't boil down to dollars, but if we're looking at the dollars, what is the rough breakdown between the what the recreational fishing industry contributes to the state economy and what the commercial fishing industry contributes? Jerry Schill.
Well, it's not just a matter of dollar and cents. I mean,
sure.
As far as recreational is concerned, we agree. Many commercial fishermen also recreationally fish. But to coastal North Carolina, the recreational community is extremely important. Commercially, though, we have not done the economic impact study that the recreational community has done, and that's something that we vitally need. But in addition to that, it's important to note that when you combine all commercial fishermen and all recreational fishermen, that's well less than 10% of the population of North Carolina. Yet those public trust resources are owned by everyone, so that the only access that the vast majority of folks have to those resources as far as a source of protein is through the commercial fishing channels. And that's an important component of these debates.
Jess Hawkins.
And it's becoming even more important, as these two fellows here can tell you, or BJ, is that we import a lot of our seafood, and we're one of the top consumers in the world of seafood. And there's a movement, as you're probably familiar here in Wilmington, with outsourcing vegetables locally and acquiring seafood locally, poultry locally. And so within the restaurant industry itself, what little bit I know about that, I love to go to independent restaurants. You know, they try to provide a local product, whether it's a vegetable or seafood. And so you see that voice becoming louder also and becoming more important. Because again, some people like to eat seafood and some people prefer to eat local seafood.
We had a caller who left this comment. Mac from Coastal Carolina says the issue isn't what's coming out of the water. It's what's going into the water and polluting it. The more development, less fish stocks and habitat. Anyone like to comment on that? Jerry Schill.
Well, the one thing that was mentioned earlier, Jess mentioned non-point source and point source discharges. One thing that was left out of that, and it's maybe a little dangerous to mention it today in Wilmington, but golf courses can also be a source of non-point source pollution especially in terms of fertilizers and things like that. And we have a significant number of golf courses in coastal Carolina.
Yes, we do. And there's a significant event happening right now.
Yes,
Eagle Point.
As we can attest to coming down 17.
Yes, certainly. You got caught in the traffic in Hempstead. Jess Hawkins.
And especially a great example of that, Rachel, would be oysters. And so, you know, there's a growing demand for oysters in our country, and we have the technology to grow them, aquaculture. You have the technology to harvest them by wild, a long history. But if you don't have clean water, you cannot harvest those oysters because they are filter feeders the way they're made. And so, and in this area alone, you have most of your waters down here are closed to shellfish harvest. And we as in the state and the entities, the governing entities, haven't done a good job of cleaning those waters up, even though the Clean Water Act 1972 says that's not supposed to happen.
Okay, so let's go back to the 1990s. This moratorium has been put in place on commercial fishing licenses, on further regulation until studies are done and policymakers can assess what the best way to move forward is with responsible fisheries management. So at this point, most of you, Dick Brame, Jerry Schill, Jess Hawkins, and BJ Copeland, who is not with us in this segment but will be with us in the next, you were part of this conversation. How did we get from there to the Fisheries Reform Act of 1997? What did that ultimately say about how we were going to manage this thing? Dick Brame.
Well, I think the most important part of the Fisheries Reform Act is they decided to manage by fishery management plan rather than by guess and by gosh.
So there was something on paper that you could.
Well, there was a process you had to go through mm-hmm. in order to manage the fishery.
And what was that process?
The fishery management plan process, which is I can't go into right. It's too long to go into now, but it is a process you go through to manage fisheries. and create a plan that people have their input, and you come out with a product that the public knows is coming. But also, I think you change the Marine Fisheries Commission from a 17-member, highly parochial commission to a much more manageable 9-member. Now, it hasn't done, from the recreational perspective, it's not done what we'd like to see necessarily, but it certainly is a better way to manage than a 17-member commission.
The Fisheries Reform Act of 1997 changed the structure of that commission.
It changed the structure of that, and it created a licensing structure, although it did leave out the recreational saltwater fishing license.
Jerry Schell.
Yeah, I agree. The most important component of the FRA of 97 was it established the process, and that was key. And lowering that number did make it more manageable. I will say, though, that from our perspective, and a lot of, again, this gets back to internal, there was extreme distress among the commercial community with the ultimate Fisheries Reform Act. We had meaning the state, there was a group called the Fishing Freedom Fighters that were commercial fishermen, recreational fishermen that didn't agree with any of this. And believe me, it made our life pretty rough for a while because it was a compromise bill.
Right.
Dick Brame and I both attended the signing ceremony in the Capitol when Governor Hunt signed it, and we were both given a pen. But I don't think I was smiling at that ceremony. It was because it was a compromise bill.
Neither was I.
And we're about to go to break. Jess Hawkins, when we come back, we'll hear from you. You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation about fisheries management in North Carolina, why it's so complicated, and how a 20-year-old law might be ready for a substantial update. When we come back from this break, it'll be your last chance to ask your own question. You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It's conversation about fisheries management and the history of it in North Carolina, why it's so complicated, and how a 20-year law could be facing some substantial change. We're talking today with Dick Brame with the Coastal Conservation Association of North Carolina. Also joining us from the studios of member station WUNC is B.J. Copeland. He served as director of North Carolina Sea Grant College from 1972 to 1996, and he served on the North Carolina Marine Fisheries Commission and the Fisheries Moratorium Steering Committee. Jerry Schell is the Director of Government Relations for the North Carolina Fisheries Association. And Jess Hawkins, former marine biologist with the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries and former Marine Fisheries Commission liaison. You can ask your own question on this Thursday about the fishing industry, the history of it in North Carolina, by calling us today at 910-343-1138 or sending us an email at coastline@whqr.org. But first, we're going to ask you to run through the names and titles of all the folks on the panel today. That's a joke. Jess Hawkins, just before we went to break, you wanted to make a point, and the joke is just landing now.
Just to reiterate what Dick said, we felt very strongly as public servants that the FMPs would serve, the fishery management plans would serve as a deposit or a synthesis of what scientists knew about a fish, and it would also incorporate social and economic. So it would give policymakers a document that would guide any potential decision making in addition to the process. It was a very open process, like what Dick said, so that anybody, whether you could go to the meeting and provide input, Jerry could go to the meeting and provide input, Dick could go to the meetings and provide input. And it's a deliberative process. It took over about a year plus to develop those FMPs.
So when you're talking about regulating fisheries, Jerry Schell, you talked about allocation. So that includes the number of fishing licenses, what you can bring in a catch. What other kinds of issues around fishing get regulated for those folks who aren't fisher people?
Well, allocation also it also allocates who gets the fish in terms of user group too, recreational versus commercial in many cases. But your question again was,
does it address how you fish?
Oh my, yes. I get that a lot. Honest questions. People with no agendas will say, why isn't the fishing industry regulated? They may be talking about shrimpers or gill netters or whatever the case may be. And as one who's done this for about 30 years now, it is highly regulated. And people by nature don't like regulations. Do fisheries need to be regulated? Absolutely, because it's a public trust resource. Do fishermen like to be regulated? No. But still, that's because they're red-blooded Americans. That's just the way it is. But there's regulations on when gear, first of all, what the gear can be, when it can be set, the times it can be set. There are seasons, there are quotas as far as how much you can catch, and of course there are size limits. So there's a joke that, you know, a fisherman has to have a lawyer on his boat to understand what the regulations are, and it's pretty much true. Even those that do it for a living have trouble keeping up with it all.
B.J. Copeland, can you explain the difference between the Fisheries Management Plan and the Fisheries Reform Act?
Well, the Fisheries Reform Act includes Fisheries Management Plan process, and the Fisheries Management Plan process involves stakeholders for all user groups, including environmentalists, commercial, recreational, scientific people. And they listen to advisory committees. These advisory committees are set up by the Fisheries Reform Act to provide input into the process of setting a management plan. A management plan is a five-year plan. It is required to be reviewed and revised accordingly at the end of 3 years. You've started the process over again. And so the Fisheries Management Plan is a roadmap for how the fishery will be managed during that time period. It includes input from everyone who's involved in that particular fishery, whether they're recreational or commercial or environmental or whatever.
We have an email from Buddy. He asks, how important is sustainable harvest to a fisheries management scenario? Jess Hawkins.
It's very important. So when you collect the science, you're trying to determine the population levels or the sustainable aspects of that fish population. And so it's very difficult to do. So scientists like BJ and myself, we used to go out and try to design studies to try to determine what the population level was. And then by knowing what the population level it was or is, then you try to determine what is the acceptable take. And then you determine what Jerry was talking about, the allocation, who gets that part of the take. And so it's the utmost importance.
Dick Brame.
And sustainable is in the eye of the beholder. What recreational fishermen want is different from what commercial fishermen want. We'd like a much more abundant resource.
And so that means you would like more limits on what can be taken out of the water? Is that what that means?
We would. Yes, we'd like to have more abundant resource. They're easier to catch, basically.
So from your point of view, for a moment, you don't have to consider the needs, sorry, Jerry, of commercial fishermen at all. You can write this ticket the way you want it to be written. What would change?
Well, at first you decide what species are most important recreationally. I mean, certainly we're not talking about managing crabs this way, crabs or clams or oysters or shrimp. But the important recreational fisheries that say the top 10, the bluefish, the used to be croaker and spot, they've become less and less abundant. But the species that are important, the recreational fishery, should be managed for abundance in our view.
And how is that different from managing from a commercial point of view?
Well, if you had a population of fish, you just say we discovered a population of widget fish, in order to manage the maximum sustainable yield, which is the gold standard, you'd fish that population down by about 40 or 50%. So you'd have more yield. They would be churning more fish, producing more fish annually. We like to have a more abundant resource, some old fish. You not only want to have a chance to catch the fish, you want to catch a whopper every now and again to maximize the recreational fishery.
And Jerry Schill, how does that diverge from what commercial fishermen need?
Well, first of all, sustainable fisheries is critical for commercial fishermen if they want to have a future. So managing for sustainable yield is absolutely the right way to go. But you know, in the area of the providing consumers, you know, that's what our guys do. They want the fish to be available to the fish market, to the restaurant, and for people to take home to eat that don't fish. So in that regard, there has to be an economy of scale where there have to be enough, the volume has to be there to where the average consumer, you don't want this healthy source of protein to be only available to the highest bidder. It has to be available to the lower end of the socioeconomic scale as well as the people that can afford it.
B.J. Copeland, I heard you chuckle a little bit when we were talking about what a sustainable harvest is. Why?
Well, I was chuckling about what recreational fishermen want is big fish and what commercial fishermen want are a lot of fish. Those two things might not be real compatible, but a sustainable fishery is one in which would the yield of the spawning stock would be sustaining the population at some current level. And if you fish it down too far on the big ones, you get less little ones. And so, you know, the idea is to have a balance of fish that would sustain the population.
When we look at the state of the fisheries in North Carolina now compared to the way it was 20 years ago, have our concerns escalated? Have they improved? Where are we now, Jess Hawkins?
Some fish are up and some fish are down. So we have a great diversity of fisheries resources. What has changed is the desire to catch them has greatly intensified, like what Dick said, by recreational fishermen. And so there's a lot more recreational fishermen trying to catch fish based on information and based on one that's grown up in eastern North Carolina. A lot of people like to fish now for fun. And so some fish are doing well. Again, some fish are not doing well. And so it varies with the fish. It varies with the fishery.
And what are the species of particular concern right now?
Well, summer flounder is a very important fish to commercial fishermen and very important to recreational fishermen north of here. And overfishing was occurring on that. It's not overfished. And so the federal government and the interstate compact that's responsible for managing migratory species put in some severe measures on recreational fishermen to the north and put on severe measures that really affect commercial fishermen here and affect somewhat recreational fishermen here. The bag limit was lowered, like what Jerry mentioned, the limits are paced where there's limits on recreational fishermen also, so it's down to four. So that's one species. Wheatfish has pretty much not been abundant in North Carolina waters for a while, and the scientists indicate that fishing is not causing that, but they're still not here until maybe recently we may be seeing some signs coming back. So that is a concern. When I was a young boy, I used to go fishing with my daddy recreationally for wheatfish. And so other species, it goes, the story's up and down. You know, some are healthy, we think are healthy, and some are not healthy.
You said you don't think fishing is the cause of the depletion of wheatfish.
Well, wheatfish, the scientists, not just what I think, I'm just repeating what scientists have found. They found that you divide... when you harvest a fish, that's called fishing mortality from a recreational or commercial standpoint. Then nature kills some fish, and they think that nature is killing most of the weak fish for whatever reason, predation or lack of spawning success. It could be climate, we're not sure, but and as Jerry mentioned, you know, fish, some fish species undergo tremendous cycles, and so weak fish is one that has been, you know, that was fished in our state and that 1918s to 1920s, and then it disappeared in the 1960s. And so now, and then they came back in the 1980s, we had the largest abundance of wheatfish that we've seen in the history of our state. And hopefully they're coming back now.
B.J. Copeland.
Let's throw into that mix global warming. Our ocean temperatures are warmer now than they were 20 years ago. And some fish have been pushed further north. Some fish have been pushed further south. I mean, all kinds of things are happening out there that doesn't have anything to do with fishing.
Mm-hmm. And B.J. Copeland, when you think about 20 years ago, having served on the North Carolina Marine Fisheries Commission and the Fisheries Moratorium Steering Committee, everyone kind of acknowledges that the Fisheries Reform Act was a compromise bill. What would you change about that bill, first of all, and how do you think it needs to change two decades later?
I don't think it needs to change at all. I thought we had a pretty good plan. The problem is in the details, and the details are in the hands of people who serve in these positions. You know, it's not going to be a perfect world, so the framework, I think, is pretty solid.
Are you concerned about the future of fisheries management, B.J. Copeland? If you could put a bug in the ear of the people who will be shaping this next policy, what would you say to them?
Leave it alone.
Okay, Dick Brame, same question. What do you think needs to change when you think about what we have and what we need for the future going forward?
Well, I like the emphasis on conservation in the new bill. That I've only read it once. I haven't seen it that much. But I like the emphasis on conservation where it provides guideposts and measurable things for the fishery to be measured by.
Jerry Schell.
Well, you can't ignore the politics of it all. While I agree with BJ that I think the Fisheries Reform Act does give us the required framework, a bill has been introduced, although I've been told it was primarily get everybody at the table to talk. The key component here is doing it. If we are going to talk about redoing the Fisheries Reform Act, we need to do it in the open light of stakeholder input like we did the Moratorium Steering Committee 20 years ago. Doing it through the General Assembly is not the best way to do it. They need to go back to the old way of getting the stakeholders together to talk about the issues because, you know, in commercially, the number of fishermen, since I started 30 years ago, the number of fishermen have declined precipitously. The number of boats participating commercially have declined, yet the average age of a fisherman has increased. Now, that's a cultural shift. It just isn't unique to fisheries.
So it's not because it's harder to make a living as a fisherman today than it was, say, 50 years ago?
To a certain degree, but the cultural shift I refer to is we depend, as a culture, we don't particularly like jobs where we wear out our deodorant. We don't like to do things with our hands anymore. We have these things we look at when we walk around and walk into buildings while we're looking at our phones. That's an old guy talking. So it's a cultural shift. It's not unique to fishing.
Jess Hawkins.
Yeah, I kind of agree with what BJ was saying. Is it's a good framework. I do wish we had more stakeholder input. And so when you work for the government, you're a public servant. And so I think the advisory committees need to be more functional. I think the commission could look at the federal models, having scoping meetings where people like Dick or Jerry could go in and initiate that. Right now it seems to be we're minimizing the input. The current commission is hesitant to try to access their advisors unless they have to. And so there's a lot of people in our state that care about our resources and a lot of good, very good scientists, a lot of recreational fishermen that know a lot about catching fish, a lot of good commercial fishermen that know a lot about catching fish or they care about the resource.
And so this policy could use that input.
Since you serve the people and these are public trust resources, I see that's where that could be better. And if you redesign it, you definitely need to have stakeholders like Dick and Jerry at the table.
That's this edition of Coastline. B.J. Copeland, Jerry Schell, Dick Brame, Jess Hawkins, thank you all so much for joining us today. And special thanks to member station WUNC for making Dr. Copeland's appearance possible. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Caleb Covington engineered today's show. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org, get the podcast, or check it out on our HQR app. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 2. Join us for Coastline Live Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.